I had some planned questions, but I think there's enough interest here that I don't really have to direct you. What I really would like is for you to satisfy all your curiosity right now when you're in this panel of experts that know a great diversity of different subjects about stem cells. So I encourage you to ask questions of all or any of these scientists.
In the case of transdifferentiation, in many cases you'll have terminally differentiated cells that don't divide, so you can't expand them. Wouldn't that be a limitation for that method?
That's certainly a major limitation. In our case, I should say that it is important the cell type you start with, and the memory has been indicated throughout the day. And we have tested different mesenchymal stem cells, and it seems that there is some variation, but in general, you can transdifferentiate them. So the initial cell type can be expanded. The final cell type, in some cases, will not be able to be expanded. I agree with you. But I wanted to show this as an example of an alternative way, not just the only way.
Are there any questions up here? I've labored all the way up these steps. Anybody
yeah,
any
come
questions?
On, guys. What? Somebody from my lab ask a question.
So I'm not an expert in mesenchymal stem cells, but I remember that Irv Weissman at the ISSCR meeting in San Francisco made a very bold statement saying that we should accept that there are no mesenchymal stem cells. And so which means, are there ways to better define mesenchymal stem cells, or are there clear markers that really distinguish them from other cellular states?
Certainly, there are markers that we all understand that they define that compartment that are different from a fully differentiated cell.
So we actually do have. I have to do it again.
Yeah, they're starting. People are starting to warm up a little bit.
I have a question for Alex. So if you have in your plot where you have iPS and ESL, if you plot cancer cell, do you see any overlap?
We haven't done that. So there's certainly going to be some markers, some of the signatures that are overlapping, but it's hard to tell right now without doing it where they would actually fall.
I relate this to trying to, when you're evaluating a therapy, and I'm someone who was approved for a bone marrow transplant and turned it down. And, the challenge is for people to be able to understand the confidence level that you have. And that in science, I think, is a tough thing to come up with because there are so many risks in divulging that. So that's I think, as a patient approaching this, is that's kind of one of the biggest issues, is really what's the, how does it relate out of the, what I always think about, out of the dish to the patient.
And I'm not sure we're really helping very much because we're publishing a lot of papers that directly disagree with each other. So if you follow the primary literature, it can be very confusing. And I think this is just a, as Rudolf Janisch said, this is an overheated field. And I actually think that's a good thing because we have so many eyes looking at the same problems now that we're bound to come up with better ideas than if we were one person in a basement somewhere.
But isn't that one of the fundamental problems? I mean, you want to get your work out to a larger audience.
Yeah.
So, and the public in general seems to think that what you deliver, what science delivers is certitude. And so they expect stories that create headlines, deliver certain responses, and then they're all aghast when 6 months later there's a rebuttal comes or a rejection or the New York Times says the thing about the depression gene, sorry, wrong, didn't get it right. So, and then how do you convince a larger audience that science is not in the belief business, it's more in the doubt business? Without losing
you're
them.
Asking me this, aren't you?
Anybody.
I would love to hear from anyone else on the panel. But I, the nature of a really fast-moving field, and I I absolutely sympathize with people. I learn a lot from reading the New York Times as well about science. It isn't even my colleagues in the stem cell world. I often learn about their the interpretation of the journalist. So I'm not sure what the solution is. I would love to hear something. We all want to be really good and solid scientists, but the facts are that this is a very competitive field. You can tell that by how many people there are in the audience. And there is a rush to publish, and there's limited funding, and we all compete for it. So it isn't, I think the good thing is that the science is moving very fast. I think the shortcoming of moving very fast is that people tend to trip along the way occasionally.
So I'll just say a complete solution to this problem is probably going to come around about the time that stem cell research provides us with cures for all known diseases. So we're probably not going to get that, but that doesn't mean there isn't anything we can do and try. And part of that is something that many of you know that I'm an advocate for, which is that scientists know best the nature of how science works, what we know, what we don't know, what's possible, what's impossible. And if they fail to engage with the public about those issues and help them understand them, then it's not going to be surprising that the public will be baffled by the fact that today you get one answer and tomorrow you get a different answer. And there are forums in San Diego where we can do that. And rather than be an advertiser for my own forums, I will just say you can talk to me about it if you want to learn about
that. Oh, go ahead and advertise.
Center for Ethics and Science and Technology, ethicscenter.net.
I think something that's a really positive direction is, 5 years ago, big pharma and big biotech wouldn't go anywhere near a stem cell. I mean, I was there, and there was no interest. It was viewed as very high risk. And what we've seen, because of all of the basic research that's being done and even some of the preclinical work that's being done in the academic sector, is that big pharma now and biotech are becoming very interested in stem cells and regenerative medicine. And that really changes, the rate at which this is going to be done, because they have the resources to run these large clinical trials, okay, which is really what it takes to begin to translate these ultimately to human therapies. So I think in my view, in terms of the therapeutic application of stem cells, probably one of the most interesting things that's happened is the stimulation of big pharma to really become a player in this area.
Just a question. How does any of the panel, including yourself, view this era as sort of like the 70s and 80s with monoclonal antibodies, where maybe occasionally you'll have a beta interferon come out, but maybe it's more about the processing technologies and establishing the foundations, and then, of course, 3 decades later now everybody does some sort of targeted therapy. So we're really at that stage. Any comment?
That's actually, I'll start and you guys can comment, because I think that's very interesting. All of the people here on this panel are using pretty high-tech tools, as I pointed out in the first place. And I think it's very enabling for us to put together next generation sequencing and methylome sequencing and high throughput screening and genotyping together with stem cells. It seems like a perfect marriage to me. And I think these people are certainly representative of that happy union.
I think the similarity is back in the 80s when everybody thought monoclonal antibodies were the end all, they weren't. But I think what really made the field progress was picking the right targets, the right disease targets to make the right antibodies against, and then we got anti-CD20 and Herceptin and so forth. And I think that's very much true of stem cells, is you need to really pick the right disease targets and the right stem cell therapy. And once you do that and you get a few examples, I think many more will come. And so that's the similarity between, I think, the two enterprises.
This question is mainly for Alex, pertaining to your profiling of cells at the beginning and end of differentiation experiments. You showed that a particular loci in H1s is methylated and you don't get expression of that gene. Do you have examples of another case where cell lines may be similar in the pluripotent state but acquire different methylation profiles under the same induction protocols? And to speak to the point that are there things that we can't see in the pluripotent state that may be of a consequence in differentiation.
Right, so I think that's why we ended up developing this additional assay of differentiating BBs and measuring their gene signatures, because there's actually a large number of things. So you're seeing, if you look at the average lines, you're seeing on the average of hundreds of different, for example, increased methylation or also decreased methylation changes. Not all of them can explain all the things we see and all the propensities, the differences between the cell lines. And so I think it's sort of this combination of everything together, where you have sort of certain things like the methylation can tell you a bit about that state while it's not differentiated, predicted, but for a few genes, what's going to happen with them in the future. But there's lots of other ones where we can do that. Should also mention, in this case, we only focused on DNA methylation. We have a lot of data that are also publicly available already on chromatin maps. So a lot of these cell types are part of the NIH roadmap for epigenomics. A lot of the data already out there, publicly available. So there's a lot of chromatin signatures that may also help understand that. And there's additional things like microRNAs that we haven't looked at. And there's a few more things that probably could help explain in the end the full picture.
Okay, we'll have one final question.
My question is in regards to the idea of trying to find the appropriate cell to choose. And the very good point was made that when it comes to human cells, we can't really do tetraploid complementation assays. How have these techniques been applied to mouse to sort of determine what are the characteristics between a good mouse iPS cell line that generates, a tetraploid complementation animal and lines that are less able to do that? And can we get some clues about what's important and develop a molecular signature to try to help us select human lines if we can't do that actual functional assay? And that's...
Louise, why don't you address that?
So we've done some work as well looking within the pluripotent space and trying to define what the range, what we call the range of pluripotency is. And we see that it falls into, I would say, three broad categories. And we, of course, are still working on this. But it appears that there are certain lines that are relatively unbiased. They don't seem to, their gene expression signatures don't seem to be leaning one way or the other, and they seem more similar to more immature embryonic cells. Then we have another category that appear more biased, and they sort of have this, maybe we don't understand the organization, but what we see so far is a relatively disorganized low-level expression of early lineage-specific genes, and then we have sort of an intermediate state. So we're just getting the first hints of perhaps being able to subcategorize the pluripotent space into cells that have different propensities.
Okay, that's great. Okay. Thank you, Jane.
I would like, did you want to have we have a patient advocate always gets the last word.
I guess when I choose to get the microphone, I have a question I really would ask is, what do you need to get to that place? You know, I'm always curious as to what can the public do? What resources can we bring? I mean, money's always an answer, but is there tissue? Is there more, what is it that could help you?
One, two, three. I can give you a very concrete example. I have 5 postdocs in the lab for 1 year. And we are trying to get samples from 3 diseases that we think we can cure in the lab. And we cannot get them for a year. So that's something that perhaps you could help. And I am sure that many other labs have ideas how to do correct by homologous recombination that particular disease, how to differentiate that cell type to the one you need to and do some preclinical assays. And we are encountering many, many problems in talking to doctors, other people. Can we get just a small sample to do the experiment in the lab? And as I said, these people in the lab are being paid. They know what they have to do. They don't have the sample. Can you do something?
Yeah. I think we all need a break. So I'd like to thank the members of this panel for a really interesting and exciting session.